week 8 of our journey with how to be an anti-racist. Today is the last day. This is the last audio for this book. So I'll be talking about chapter 17 and 18, the final two chapters. Next week, as most of you know, is week 9. And during the final week of our time with the book, there's no new reading assignments, no new audio, so that you can use that time for catch up and integration. So here we are, finishing up this book. Let's start by taking a deep breath, inhaling slowly, and exhaling. Okay, let's talk about chapter 17, success. The main ideas of this chapter are about what success looks like and what Ibram thinks it will take to get there. So first, there's the question of defining success, which Ibram describes as, quote, the dark road we fear, where anti-racist power and policy predominate, where equal opportunities and thus outcomes exist between the equal groups, where people blame policy, not people, for societal problems, where nearly everyone has more than they have today, where racist power lives on the margins, like anti-racist power does today, where anti-racist ideas are our common sense, like racist ideas are today. Okay, so we're envisioning a different world. He describes it as the dark road we fear. Maybe because it's so new and we're scared of things that are new. In our last book club discussion, we spent a few minutes in the beginning imagining, closing our eyes and just seeing what came to mind when we imagined a world without racism. And that turned out to be a very interesting exercise. Maybe we'll do it again next time and we'll read this beforehand, thinking about, okay, where nearly everyone has more than they have, racist power lives on the margins, equal opportunities and outcomes. Common sense. Wouldn't it be nice if anti-racist ideas were common sense, like racist ideas are today? So then Ibram goes on to say, and this really strikes me as key, neither failure nor success is written. The story of our generation will be based on what we are willing to do. This reminds me of a quote I came across recently from Buckminster Fuller, who some of you may remember. Lynn Twist mentioned him in her book, The Soul of Money, which we read a while ago. He was a great thinker, inventor, architect, futurist, author, very interesting guy. Not alive anymore. He was he died in like the 60s or 70s. Anyway, he had this quote, which struck me when I read it, which is, "We know now that what we could never have known before." Okay, I'm screwing this up. Let me start again. "We know now what we never could have known before, that we now have the option for all humanity to make it successfully on this planet in this lifetime. Whether it is to be utopia or oblivion will be touch and go right up to the final moment." In short, the outcome is unknown, just like the outcome is always unknown. None of us can see the future. We never know what's going to happen next. And really, maybe the outcome is none of our business, right? Because that's not here. We're here now. And so I've been thinking about how maybe the question is not, how will this turn out? But instead, what is mine to do? Because really, don't we have a responsibility, if we choose to see it this way and accept it, to do our best to live in integrity, whatever that means to us, independent of the outcome? As we've been reading these last few chapters, Ibram has begun talking about the anti-racist power within, the releasing and using of which may be part of each of our paths of personal integrity. If we define it as such, that's an individual decision. So in this chapter, he shares how his friend Kari Dad, a fellow professor, freed the anti-racist power within her students. And I really love this. He writes, quote, "She did not free the anti-racist power within them with ideological attacks. Her classes were more like firm hugs tailored to each student's experience, compelling self-reflection." Man, this description, like, I intend to keep it in the front of my mind in the conversations I have with people. Because if we happen to be talking about racism or politics or any other societal issue where there's differing viewpoints, what if I go into that conversation thinking, how can I share my viewpoint like a firm hug tailored to my conversation partner's experience? Not because I need to convince them of anything, but because I want to practice speaking up for what I believe in without being judgy or condescending. That is a growth edge for me for sure. And I loved how Robin DiAngelo talked about that at the end of White Fragility, that she has stopped trying to convince anybody of anything. But instead, her commitment to speaking up and identifying and dismantling white supremacy is speaking up because it's in her personal integrity to disrupt the system, rather than because she has a need to try to convince anybody else of anything. And that makes a lot of sense. That has continued to like roll around in my mind as we've been reading this book. Okay, so a bit later, Ibram spends a paragraph on something that I just also viewed as really essential. He shares about a time when he asked a speaker a series of leading questions. And this was after I think he had completed his master's degree or maybe his PhD already. Anyway, he was very well educated on the topic of racism. And so he had his viewpoint of like, well, I know a lot about this. And so this is what I think. And I'm right. And so because of that, the speaker expressed a view that was a little different than what Ibram believed. And so he asked him a series of questions, trying to bait him into getting defensive so that they could kind of have a conversation slash Ibram could have the opportunity to show the speaker why his viewpoint was wrong and Ibram's was right. Ever been there? Been there personally. Gotta admit I've been there. But the speaker didn't take the bait. And that turned out to be a gift for Ibram because it helped him to see that he was in the practice of closing himself off to, quote, new ideas that didn't feel good. Meaning, I shopped for conceptions of racism that fit my ideology and self-identity. So the speaker had said racism is like a disease. And Ibram was like, no, I think racism is like an organ, like essential to the functioning of the human body. Racism is essential to the functioning of the culture and the society of the United States. Well, we can see there's a very different thing there, right? Because a disease can be addressed and healed and eradicated. An organ, well, it's always going to be part of the body, pretty much. Unless it's an appendix, and then maybe you can get rid of it, or a kidney, something that you could live without. But most organs we need. And so that sort of foundational framework of the way you see it has everything to do with how we will proceed, right? So then he goes on to share, well, now he thinks he sees racism like a cancer. And he had the chance to really get up close and personal with developing that analogy as both he and his wife fought cancer, both when they were young in their 30s. Anyway, I want to go back to this point that he made after he was talking about the speaker. So he says, asking anti-racists to change their perspective on racism can be as destabilizing as asking racists to change their perspective on the races. Anti-racists can be as doctrinaire in their view of racism as racists can be in their view of not racism. How can anti-racists ask racists to open their minds and change when we are closed-minded and unwilling to change? I ignored my own hypocrisy, as people customarily do when it means giving up what they hold dear. Giving up my conception of racism meant giving up my view of the world and myself. And this strikes me as a very astute description of the divisiveness in politics today. On both the liberal and conservative sides, there's a lot of rigidity, a lot of I'm right and you're wrong, which is not getting us anywhere. We only have to look at the gridlock in Congress to see that. And then we can see the mirrors of it in our own lives, probably. So one question, like when I get really honest with myself, instead of being like, well, yeah, Congress isn't doing it right, but I got it down. Oh, really, Annette? Like, really? Because I have certainly been guilty of approaching conversations from a place of ideology instead of openness. And so one question I've been asking myself when I have these conversations where I end up frustrated with the other person's seeming inability to see past their own viewpoint is, how am I like this person? How am I also stuck in my views? And this goes back to what we learned from Byron Katie when we read her book, Loving What Is, a while ago. Some of you were there for that. One of her teachings is that whenever we're having a stressful thought, we should turn it around and see if the opposite thought is at least as true as the original thought. So if the stressful thought is, he's so stubborn and refuses to see past his ideology, the turnaround is, I'm so stubborn and I refuse to see past my ideology. And I found in self-reflection after difficult conversations, if I really sit with that, it's true. And that helps me to get off my high horse and actually open up to real dialogue, real giving and receiving of ideas. So there's that. And it's just so key. I'm thinking again of Brené Brown. I read from her book in an earlier audio. There's a lot here. To me, this strikes me as like the kind of two-pronged approach to my own journey is one, like learning about everything I need to learn in order to create a more equitable society. And of course, I have lots of deconditioning to do around that. And then also just not like learning, but having an open palm and not getting stuck in it and not thinking that I'm right and others are wrong, which is such a common response to have, especially when we first start learning. So, you know, it takes maturity. It takes like emotional and spiritual maturity to walk that path. And so for me, it's a constant growth edge. Okay. Other main points from this chapter are a review of the premise that it's not about the total white community versus the total black community, because racism also negatively affects many white people, if not most white people. And there are some black people on whom it has had a positive effect. They have seen the system and taken on being like using it to their advantage, like Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas from the Supreme Court. A review in this chapter, Ibram also reviews why he prefers to say racist policies instead of institutional racism. I think this makes a lot of sense. He argues that it's more clear and to the point, and it can be understood even if you haven't done a lot of reading and learning about racism, right? So you and I and people in this book club, like maybe a lot of the people we're around, have been doing our homework so we can kind of be like, oh, institutional racism, I understand that. But it took a while, right? And Ibram wants to be able to talk to anybody and speak in language that they can understand, even if they haven't done sort of background reading and research yet, or even if they never do. He's saying, well, but still, you can say racist policies and people understand that much easier than institutional racism. Plus, it conceptualizes the goal in a more concrete way. So instead of trying to change, quote, the system, which is abstract and it's hard to pin down what that actually means, which makes it easy to not actually do anything. The goal of anti-racists is to identify and replace specific policies and policymakers. Okay, that is a lot more clear. I just want to get clear on where are the racist, where are the inequities? Okay, where are the racist policies that leads to those inequities? Okay, who are the policymakers who have passed those racist policies? And how can we change them out for policymakers who will pass anti-racist policies? Or decision makers, doesn't have to just be policy on the level of law and government, could be in any kind of realm, right? Education, business, whatever it may be. And then Ibram in this chapter kind of details his own step-by-step process for his own lifelong mission to be anti-racist, which I won't take the time to repeat live on the audio, but it's on page 226, and it's a really nice summary of how he personally tries to live all of the concepts from this book. Okay, now let's talk about chapter 18, Survival. So in this chapter, he shares about both he and his wife's battles with cancer. And it seems, he doesn't say this outright, but maybe this is my own projection because I'm seeing what I believe, but I think there tends to be a rhyme and reason to these kinds of things. And so I see Ibram as believing that, like, oh, like maybe there was a reason he needed to get so up close and personal with cancer as he got so up close and personal with racism. So he could like have that in this analogy now to see them, to see racism as like a cancer, and then to apply similar modes of thinking to, okay, so how do we overcome it? For example, he sees now, which he didn't see in the beginning, that researching and educating to change minds isn't effective. So that would be like someone dedicating their lives to researching and educating people about what causes cancer. Sure, people would learn some things, right? But it wouldn't create much actual change. But if a medical professional in the cancer field put their energy towards identifying and systematically addressing the root causes of cancer instead of its symptoms and repercussions, well, that actually can create change, right? In the way that like in our approach, in people's ability to heal, survive and heal those types of cancers. So of course, then the analogy is what Ibram does now, which is researching and educating to change policy instead of to change minds. And then towards the end of this chapter, Ibram continues the cancer analogy when he writes, "Racism is not even 600 years old. It's a cancer that we've caught early. But racism is one of the fastest spreading and most fatal cancers humanity has ever known. It is hard to find a place where its cancer cells are not dividing and multiplying. There is nothing I see in our world today, in our history, giving me hope that one day anti-racists will win the fight, that one day the flag of anti-racism will fly over a world of equity. What gives me hope is a simple truism. Once we lose hope, we are guaranteed to lose. But if we ignore the odds and fight to create an anti-racist world, then we give humanity a chance to one day survive, a chance to live in communion, a chance to be forever free." Anybody else feel chills upon reading that? So Ibram sees the odds as against us, but he also faced stage 4 colon cancer where the odds were against him. And he didn't give up hope. And he kept showing up for the fight, and he won. He beat the cancer. So it's a useful analogy, right? If we could not give up hope, we can look with clear eyes at the odds and at the reality and not give up hope, because we know if we give up hope, we are guaranteed to lose. And that, yeah. So we just got to keep showing up for the fight. The outcome, like I said earlier, may be not the point, even if it drives us, even if the vision of an anti-racist world drives us, right? And he talks about that. He identified things he wanted to live for. We can identify, oh, yes, the anti-racist world I want to live in, this is what it looks like. And we still have to keep coming back to here and now, and what do I need to do today to be in the fight? So this leaves us with the question, how do we show up for the fight in our anti-racist journey? And Ibram details the steps on pages 231 and 232. He says they are to admit racial inequity is a problem of bad policy, not bad people. Identify racial inequity in all its intersections and manifestations. Investigate and uncover the racist policies causing racial inequity. Invent or find anti-racist policy that can eliminate racial inequity. Figure out who or what group has the power to institute anti-racist policy. Disseminate and educate about the uncovered racist policy and anti-racist policy correctives. Work with sympathetic anti-racist policymakers to institute the anti-racist policy. Deploy anti-racist power to compel or drive from power the unsympathetic racist policymakers in order to institute the anti-racist policy. Monitor closely to ensure the anti-racist policy reduces and eliminates racial inequity. When policies fail, do not blame the people. Start over and seek out new and more effective anti-racist treatments until they work. Monitor closely to prevent new racist policies from being instituted. So that's kind of the playbook, right? And this is a very interesting time to read this as we are now less than 2 weeks away from the election. There's a lot at stake. Hopefully everybody listening to this is planning to vote because that is an essential part of this process, right? As you are voting, as we are voting, are we looking up, okay, who am I voting for and what are their policies, racist or anti-racist? What amendments to the Constitution or what propositions am I voting for or against, and which ones will produce more equity and which ones will produce less equity or just contribute to the system continuing as it is? Big questions, interesting moment in time to be finishing up this book. Timing, the universe, so interesting. Okay, so let's talk about calls to action. I have two suggestions for you this week. The first one is to continue to reflect on the question, how can I put the resources at my disposal towards anti-racist policy change? So that's an ongoing question to sit with. And then my second suggestion is something more tangible, not just sitting with a question, but to actually identify one tangible next step you will take on your anti-racist journey. So a lot of you read White Fragility with us. Now you read How to Be an Anti-Racist. What's next? It could be the next step in learning. It could be, you know, grabbing a few friends and grabbing another book that you have been wanting to read, creating your own book club. It could be signing up to give reoccurring donations to an anti-racist organization, even if it's just like $5 a month, $10 a month, that's something. It could be researching inequity in an arena that's especially dear to your heart, maybe education, maybe healthcare, maybe housing, you know, all kinds of different areas, and then identifying the racist policies that are creating that inequity. So whatever it is, come up with one next step. Don't let yourself get overwhelmed because there's a lot of work to do, but we can't do it all at once. Journey of 1,000 steps starts with a single step, or 1,000 miles, or whatever the quote is. So we just need one next step and then take the first step of that next step. So for me, I have signed up for a class on anti-Black racism that is taught by several different Black women leaders through an organization called Soul to Soul Sisters, which you may remember we donated money to when we read White Fragility. So that class starts in January. So that's my next tangible step. And then the other piece, because there could be more than one, is my husband and I have been talking since June around, you know, we've been donating money, but we want to kind of identify one organization that is contributing to anti-racist policy and figure out what works for our budget that we can set up as a reoccurring donation. Because we don't want it to just be this thing where we're white people that donated some money during summer 2020, when all of this was so up, right? We want it to be a continual contribution towards anti-racism, anti-racist change. So for transparency, and maybe for inspiration, those are the two things that I have on my plate right now. How about you? What's next for you? If you want to email me and share, I'd love to hear. If you need that bit of accountability, writing it down and telling someone, tell me. I'd love to hear it. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for being on this journey through how to be an anti-racist with me. It has been so valuable for me, and I hope it has been for you as well. Our next book is switching gears a little bit, but I think it's a good shift to end 2020. What a year it's been. So we're going to be reading Viktor E. Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which kind of gets at, you know, his idea of saying yes to life in spite of everything. Okay, friends, love you all. Mwah. I will talk to you again with the next book. Bye.